Welcome. I'm Mark Steiner, and before we start the body of our show, I just want to make an announcement and tell all of you what's going on today at 6 o'clock, as soon as the show is over. We'll be making a five-minute dash over to Northwood Shopping Center. There is a rally there tonight and a vigil. Enough is enough to honor Ken Harris on the spot where he was shot in front of the New Haven Lounge. Keith Covington will be there. Many of our elected political leaders will be there. Community people from all over the city will be there. Community leaders from Northwood will be there as we remember Ken Harris and also have a vigil in his honor and also talk to one another and to the city about enough is enough to end the violence and begin a new way of life in the city. And it's going to be my honor to emcee that this evening, the Enough is Enough rally at Northwood Shopping Center. Ken Harris is a dear friend, and Keith Covington, who was robbed that night and has been going through a great deal since Ken Harris's murder, is a dear, dear friend. So I encourage all of you to please join us there. Northwood Shopping Center, 6 p.m. Enough is enough to end the violence. Remember Ken Harris and join all of us out there who will be there for a brief ceremony in his honor. Let me just read one quick thing. Today, Senator Ben Cardin in the United States Senate spoke on the U.S. Senate floor to remember Ken Harris and to praise him. I just want to read that so you know what was read in his honor on the floor of the U.S. Senate today. Senator spoke this, said, Ken Harris's rise from poverty and his determination to make a difference, Ken Harris's commitment to community service began as a concerned parent who became a PTA parent of Leithwalk Elementary School. He served as president of Glen Oak Community Improvement Association, was elected to two terms of the Baltimore City Council, representing the 4th District. While on the City Council, Ken championed the rights of his constituents. He sponsored legislation to stop landlords from throwing tenants' belongings into the street. He pushed for remedial programs in Baltimore City schools. He took the police to task for not doing an effective job of community policing. And he worked to ensure that developers created opportunities for Baltimore City residents. His death is a tragic loss for all of us, Senator Cardin read into the Senate lot today. So we wanted to share that with all of you. And in this program today, later on the program, we'll be talking with Mark Sumner, who is a Daily Kos contributing editor and author of Devil's Tower column. And he wrote a really fascinating column about what is going on in the United States with the bailout of Wall Street, a very interesting view of that. You'll hear that after the break. But first, we're going to bring you another conversation. And Edgar Allan Poe was one of the, some say, great Baltimoreans. Some say great American citizens. Many cities try to claim Edgar Allan Poe. Of course, he wrote The Raven, from which the emblem and the name was taken for the Ravens football team here in Baltimore City. There's an Edgar Allan Poe house here in Baltimore, but there's also an Edgar Allan Poe house, actually it's called by a different name, in Philadelphia. And in the New York Times the other week, there was an article that said that Poe's body and his legacy belongs in Philadelphia. Well, that came as a shock to many people in Baltimore. Always thought Poe belonged here, that he was a Baltimorean. Well, was he? Where does he really belong? We'll talk about that. The man who wrote some famous lines in the poem The Raven that opens, "Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. 'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more," is what Poe wrote to begin his poem, The Raven, that became one of his most famous poems, that he actually wrote in New York City and didn't write anywhere in one of the cities that are claiming him. Well, this hour we're going to take the debate that we found in the New York Times pages and bring it here to the studios at WEAA. We're joined by Jeff Jerome, curator of the Baltimore Poe House and Museum, and Ed Pettit, who is a Philadelphia-based writer, and he of the Bibliothecary blog in Philadelphia. He came down to Philly today to hear me in our studios to debate with Jeff Jerome over who owns Poe and who should have his body. And Ed Pettit even said in the New York Times he would come down here with a shovel and steal Poe's body to take it back to Philadelphia. Well, Jeff Jerome and Ed Pettit, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
And invite you all to join us at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Your thoughts on Edgar Allan Poe and who truly owns his body and where does he really belong. Now, Poe, one of the great writers of our time, died here. And let's talk about how this debate began. It'll be so with Ed Pettit, since he's our visitor and guest from Philadelphia. Ed?
By the way, that was actually a well-done recitation to open the show for The Raven.
Thank you.
I've heard The Raven done so many times badly. It was actually really good. I was sitting here listening, wanting you to do more.
I couldn't take up the whole show. I couldn't really do the rest of it. I'd love to, but...
I wrote a piece for the Philadelphia City Paper, which is a Philadelphia weekly, alternative weekly, and about how Poe's connection to Philadelphia never gets recognized. And not only that, but that when I really looked into it, I found out that Poe's connection to Philadelphia is crucial to his writing career, to the stories that he wrote. And when people say Edgar Allan Poe, the first city that comes to their mind is Baltimore, and I'm thinking... No, the first thing that comes to their mind should be Philadelphia. Jeff's laughing.
Of course I'm laughing. The Poe family is from Baltimore, very old Baltimore family. Poe did die in Baltimore. I always say it's unfortunate that he died, but I'm glad it was in Baltimore because he was recognized by family and friends. And they buried him in his grandfather's plot, along with his grandmother and his brother Henry. And I always have to chuckle when other cities claim Poe. And let's face it, I mean, every city that Poe lived in has a claim to fame. Poe did this, he did that. But he lived in Baltimore. He wrote his first horror story right here in Baltimore. Baltimore was the first city that honored him, of course, after his death, by creating a monument that stands atop his grave. The Poe Society was formed in Baltimore to honor Poe. The Poe House opened in 1949 to preserve Poe's memory. There's a Poe statue at the University of Baltimore. And I think, what has Philadelphia done for Poe? Now, give me a few minutes and I'll think of something. Oh, there is the Poe House. However, it wasn't the city of Philadelphia that opened the Poe House in Philadelphia. It was the federal government, the National Park Service. Now, I'm sure Philadelphia has done something else in regards to Poe, but for the moment, maybe Ed can enlighten us. What else has Philadelphia done?
Well, I won't argue with that, and if it's only, and that's part of the, you know, my reasoning for having this, you know, discussion, is that people hadn't recognized Poe as a Philadelphia writer, and you know, he wrote his. It's the sports metaphor that I like to use. When you're in baseball or football, you go into the Hall of Fame. You go into the Hall of Fame under the colors of the team that you did your greatest, you had your greatest part of your career with. Poe in Baltimore is almost like minor leagues or the first couple years of his career. Philadelphia is major league. This is the time where he's putting up the big numbers, and then he goes and he finishes up a career, you know, in New York City. If there's a literary Hall of Fame, Poe's a Philadelphia writer, not a Baltimore writer, New York writer.
Well, Philadelphia was so great, he left it. So what can I say? Moved to New York.
Let me take a step backwards here and talk a bit about who Poe was. I mean, and why should anybody care? I mean, Edgar Allan Poe, a 19th century poet, a 19th century dead old white poet. And so tell me why folks should even care about Edgar Allan Poe and who he was and what he meant for American literature, for all the rest.
Ed, would you like to
start? I'll start with that. I mean, you know, a lot of the, especially the genre literature we read today, mysteries, science fiction, horror stories, you know, Poe is a Poe begins the mystery detective story. He invents that form.
With
Murders in the Rue Morgue, written in Philadelphia, of course. And I mean, the mystery detective story is invented in Philadelphia. And then featuring a detective who looks at the clues and figures out the crime in his mind. And then that, you know, inspires other detectives, especially Sherlock Holmes, which the genre continues. Poe invents that genre. He's a forefather of science fiction. Some say he's kind of begun the psychological horror story novel in the works that he created, the works before Poe. in the horror gothic field were not the same as what he was doing. So he's had enormous influence on a lot of the literature that you go into the bookstores and see right now.
And I think another reason is that when Poe wrote these strange tales of premature burial, murder, and superstition, these were things that people could relate to. Poe did not write about Frankenstein monsters. He didn't write about vampires or werewolves. He wrote about things that could happen to you. You could be buried alive. It did happen. He used the theme of premature burial in many of his stories, not because he was obsessed with it, but I think people were concerned that it could happen to me. And they created these life-preserving coffins with bells and whistles that people could use to attract attention and say, I'm buried alive. Get me out of here. He wrote about superstition and murder, torture. And he was famous for using things that were happening around him in his stories. Well, I will defer to the murders in the Rue Morgue. Prior to writing that story, there was this traveling exhibit of this monster from Africa. Well, it was an orangutan, and of course, they're not from Africa.
They're from Sumatra.
Exactly. But in that time period, people didn't know. So lo and behold, Poe writes The Murders in the Rue Morgue, where this escaped orangutan commits these horrific murders. And I can just imagine what people said. Oh, my God, we just saw that thing, you know, a while back. And when Poe lived in Richmond, there was this mummy exhibit traveling around. And lo and behold, he writes a story, Some Words with a Mummy, where the mummy comes back to life through electricity and starts debating the pros and cons of democracy versus, you know, what life was like in ancient Egypt. And in Baltimore, being buried alive, he wrote his first horror story here, Berenice, which was a shocking, gruesome story of premature burial, grave desecration, mutilation. Oh, man, it was a fun story. But because of the public reaction to it, Poe was forced to censor several paragraphs. But he discovered that while the public was outraged by the subject matter, they liked to read about it. As a result, when he unfortunately moved to Philadelphia, he continued this theme because the public enjoyed it. They liked to read about these things.
So, 410-319-8888. Do you care if we keep Poe's body in Baltimore? Does he belong here? Does he belong anywhere else? What are your thoughts about Edgar Allan Poe at 410-319-8888? Or join us here by email at the steinershow@gmail.com. We're joined by Jeff Jerome, curator of the Baltimore Poe House and Museum. Ed Pettit, who seemed to have caused this controversy in a New York Times article that I read, where he threatened to come to Baltimore, dig up Poe, and take him back with him. And he's here. He has no shovel in the room, but you never know. He's the Philadelphia-based writer of Bibliothecary, Bibliothecary blog. You can look up what he's writing as we speak. Join us here at 410-319-8888. So, I mean, how serious is it? I mean, how could you exhume Edgar Allan Poe's body and just snatch it and take it back to Philly?
It's not the – I mean, I'm not crazy. Like, I know that that kind of thing wouldn't happen. There's just, you know, I mean, there's legal things and, you know, and plus I'm certain Baltimore's not going to let go the most famous writer buried in the city. But for me, it's more of a legacy question. I mean, it's about literary history.
But I have an idea. Supposing we gave you John Wilkes Booth and you could take him. Well, nobody wants him around.
Jeff is awesome.
He liked slavery and he was a... You know, he killed our president, so you could have him. How about that? We can give him away.
Well, first of all, I think perhaps the kind people at Greenmount Cemetery might take issue with that.
And they might.
So let's say that in jest. I don't think we want anyone disturbing John's grave. But I'm sure we can round up bones someplace to give to Ed, and he can take that back.
I can understand that, you know, I mean, that Baltimore doesn't want to give up Poe. I mean, Philly's got Liberty Bell and Independence Hall and Ben Franklin and
cheesesteaks.
A lot of important stuff. And
cheesesteaks.
Yeah.
Greasy cheesesteaks, yeah.
So I get that Baltimore would not be willing to give up Poe.
Let me open the phones here. Then I want to talk about what a legacy of famous writers mean to different communities and where that legacy does belong. 410-319-8888, Edgar Allan Poe. Who does he belong to? Nicole in Reservoir Hill. You're on the air.
Mark, it's great to hear you on the air again. I followed you over to 88.9.
Good. Thank you.
This has been an awesome debate so far. I was on my way out the door to go pick up my daughter, but the guests have, they're cracking me up. I love this debate. So thank you for doing this show, because I really didn't think I was interested, and now I'm going to sit here and still listen to it. So I just wanted to say thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Bye.
I'm enjoying it, and I'll even read you the last line of his last stanza of his favorite poem, and then we'll go back to the last stanza of The Raven. I love all the stanzas. I love this poem. I love the way my friend John Astin does it when he plays Edgar Allan Poe, and when by the friend Tony Sandias, who does Poe as well. By the way, they're both in Baltimore.
Oh, yes.
Do you have any Poe reenactors in Philly?
We do. There are a couple. I can't give you the name. I don't know the names.
But not as obsessive as the ones we have here.
No.
Not as good.
And they're all both great actors.
Oh, yes.
John Astin, of course, who was in the Adams family.
As a matter of fact, John Astin will be appearing at the Poe birthday celebration in January. It seems like no other city chooses to honor Poe on his birthday. So Baltimore is going to kick off the bicentennial of Poe with two weekends of Poe events featuring John Astin. He's a great guy.
Philadelphia, of course, will be having birthday celebrations in January, too. We're having David Kelch, who's a Poe impersonator, come. And then there'll be the great Poe debate at the Philadelphia Free Library between Jeff and myself.
Aren't you having one here in Baltimore, too?
That's what I hope to do.
Yeah,
it's going to start in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Free Library.
And then we'll bring you here.
And then
I will offer, since I'm on the library board, to moderate that debate.
There you go. We'd love it.
410-319-8888. Edgar Allan Poe, The Raven, the father of the mystery story of the Western canon, buried here, tied here, wasn't born here, is he ours? Dee in Randallstown, you're on the air.
Hi,
Dee.
I believe that Edgar Allan Poe was born in Baltimore, and he's buried at his family plot, so he should stay here. And also, as a child educated in Baltimore City schools, that's the only reason I read The Raven, was because he was from Baltimore.
Uh-huh. Did you like The Raven?
Yes, I did. I found it very entertaining, and to find out when it was written, I was surprised. But, I mean, when the teacher gave us the whole biography of Edgar Allan Poe, it piqued everyone's interest to read it.
Oh,
so
interesting.
He's our writer.
That's right. I'll agree with that.
Thank you, Dee, so much for that. So did you read him in high school? Was that it?
Yes, in high school. Yes.
Very good.
It's amazing. Here it is. Approaching 2009, and we are still reading Poe. We still teach Poe in our schools. Where are the other writers from Poe's time period? They're gone, forgotten, and we are still reading Poe. I think he still reaches out and touches us with his comedies, his science fiction, his horror stories. He's timeless.
Well, let me, Dee, thanks so much for that call. I really appreciate you being part of the show, and I learned something from you today. Let's go to somebody with a different point of view, 410-319-8888. Tracy in Baltimore is on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Tracy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I'm originally from Philadelphia, and listening to this show is amazing to me because I always thought that Edgar Allan Poe was from Philadelphia. I actually went to Poe Junior High School in Philadelphia. So
Poe Junior High School?
So I find it pretty interesting that this, you know, you're having this debate. But I would imagine that having relocated from Philadelphia to Baltimore, if I'm here for 20 years, I'm from Baltimore. So if Edgar Allan Poe did live in Philadelphia for an extended period of time, it seems to me that he should be from Philadelphia.
All right, Tracy. So there was a Poe Middle School, Junior High School in Philly.
Well, there was. It changed the name. It was relocated, and it's a long story. But
okay.
They changed the name. Not surprised.
Tracy, thanks so much. So, why don't you respond, Tracy? He's a fellow Philadelphian.
That's
a
great.
A sister from Philly.
And, you know, that doesn't happen very often that you find that residents of Philly really are aware of the Poe legacy in the city. I mean, I understand that there's, you know, that I'm, that there are people who do know it, like Tracy, but it doesn't happen that often, and that's great. And again, though, what she said that, you know, if he lived a considerable amount of time in Philadelphia, he should, you know, that's where he should be, or in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. That's not really the issue, I think. I mean, it's because it's really, you know, it's the work that an author creates. And if We remember the author for his works, and if environment helps shape what they work, then that's what's central to, you know, remembering the legacy. If Philadelphia inspired stories like Murders in the Rue Morgue and Telltale Heart and The Black Cat, then that information should be known to people, that this is the place where he came up with this stuff.
Well, as we kind of sit here and debate with Jeff Jerome from here in Baltimore, who curates the Baltimore Poe House and Museum, and Ed Pettit from Philadelphia, and who has been made famous in Baltimore by the article in the New York Times where he says he was going to snatch Poe's grave, and then poor Jeff Jerome said he'd be led to talk to him and punch him in the nose. So we hope there's no physical fighting. He doesn't have shovels with him. We'll see what happens. But 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. The question on the Edgar Allan Poe, I mean, he clearly was one of the great writers in modern times, and he did create the mystery genre, and he's written some incredible poetry, and he's was a very fascinating figure, actually. But who owns a writer's soul, and who owns where what he really is, and who can really claim somebody who you know lived in Charleston for a while, where he wrote things, wrote The Raven and some of his great works in New York, lived in Philadelphia. Fenn may have been from Baltimore. He died here. Some people say face down the gutter, some people say in other ways, but he died here, he was buried here. But who can really claim?
Well, I think ultimately Poe belongs to everyone. Like I said, every city that Poe lived in has a claim to fame. He did this here, he did that there. And I think he belongs to everyone. And I think we can share Poe with other cities that want to claim him. Obviously, nobody claims his bones. He is buried here in Baltimore. And if Philadelphia feels the need to cash in on his popularity, I think we can allow them to do that.
As if Baltimore hasn't been cashing in on his popularity for decades now.
Well, we've been publicizing Poe for a long time.
What does it say, though, that the Poe House, the Poe facility in Philly gets 10,000 more people a year coming to see it than our Poe House here in Baltimore?
Well, we are open Wednesday through Saturday, limited hours. The Poe House in Philadelphia, which is a very fine house.
I've seen it.
The Park Service has done wonders with it. They're open 7 days a week, 10 to 5, including holidays. So they are open a lot longer than we are, and we manage to do about 5,000 people.
I think they're only open 5 days a week, but I think the big point is that the tourism in Philadelphia with the other attractions there is going to bring in a lot more tourists, so you're going to see more people at the Poe House.
I think what's fascinating so far is the people who have called in 410-319-8888 and come back to us and join us with your thoughts on the debate over who should own Poe's body, who should own the legacy of Poe, Philadelphia, Baltimore, some other place, that there are so many people who have grown up knowing Poe, reading him in school, and still loving the work that he did, even though it's 19th century, which can be, to some young people, kind of so foreign, you know, to the existence of a 21st century child.
Well, we do many school tours at the Poe House, and inevitably, when I ask the teacher, what stories have you read, it's The Telltale Heart, Cask of Amontillado. These are very basic stories. You know what's happening. You don't have to stop and think, what was Poe talking about? And for a seventh grader reading this, they understand fully what's happening, the Telltale Heart, superstition, you know, chopping the part out of the body, and the Cask of Amontillado, walling someone up alive. They just love this. and it introduces them to Edgar Allan Poe. When they proceed further in school, they continue to read about Poe. And I have people coming to the Poe House who visited the Poe House as part of a school group way back in the late 1970s, 1980s. Now they're married and have children, and they say, I remember that tour. I remember you talking about Edgar Allan Poe. I remember coming to this house and seeing how small it was, how tiny it is.
On the way back to the phone, I have to ask both of you a question. Let me start with you, Jeff, and then go over to Ed and get back to the phones here. What is the root of your passion for Poe, and why you really are very passionate about keeping it here and keeping Poe's legacy in Baltimore means a great deal to you? And where did that passion begin for Poe?
Well, for me, it started way back in the early 1960s with the Vincent Price movies. I remember going to the neighborhood theater, and I was actually too young to be allowed in to see these.
You had snuck in.
Well, that's one way of putting it, but that's between you and me. But you had to be 13 years old to see these films. I guess the feeling was if you were younger than that, it would induce you to become a crazed killer. I don't know. So I managed to see these Vincent Price movies, and that was my first introduction to Poe, and I was hooked at that point. I was just absolutely thrilled with what I was seeing on the big screen. But it really wasn't until the 1970s that I was reintroduced to Poe through the Baltimore Bicentennial.
And Ed?
I've always liked Poe, and incidentally, I'm actually doing a film forum in Philadelphia with those great old Vincent Price, Roger Corman flicks next month. But I, as much as I've loved Poe, boy, I just love literature written, you know, a long time ago. I read very little contemporary literature unless I'm perhaps reviewing it for newspapers, and it just, boy, it just appeals.
Let's see what appeals to our listeners here as we debate. Who owns Poe, Philadelphia or Baltimore? Edgar Allan Poe, I'm talking about. 410-319-8888. And Darnell in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Darnell.
I think certainly we have the right to claim Poe as our native son, being born here and died here. And even though he was a citizen of the world, I think we have the right to claim him as our own. And I do think that the curriculum of the public schools perhaps are not doing enough to let the students know about Poe and his work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that if we had more of that, if literature were incorporated into the school system the way it was when I went to public school, that there would be more knowledge of Poe and his writings. And perhaps even at that point, we would be able to get more funds from the government for having events at the Poe House, or events that would incorporate Poe and his literature. And I think we just need to do more to let, and the younger people especially, know about the works of Edgar Allan Poe.
Donald, I wonder if you ever think about the response that young people today have to Poe. Have you read Poe to anybody or children?
My grandchildren are too young to appreciate Poe.
Uh-huh.
But believe me, I read them and read with them the stories that I read when I was growing up.
That's wonderful.
So no doubt that I will also include Poe in that when they're old enough.
Thank you.
To understand Poe.
Thank you.
Darnell, thanks so much. Lovely to hear from you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining
Bye-bye
us.
Now.
Bye-bye. So that it stuff is really important, and I suppose, you know, when you look at this, well, let me just start this. Let me go back to Ed and ask this question. So what really motivated you to get this debate started about bringing Poe to Philly, or his body to Philly, or his legacy, whatever it is you're really trying to bring to Philly?
Part of it was the impression that caller who loves to read Poe and is believes in continuing that tradition, which I think is great, but the misimpression that she has that he was born in Baltimore and that, you know...
He was born where?
He was born in Boston.
But he hated Boston.
And
Boston hated Poe, too.
Yes. And Poe had that problem everywhere he went. I mean, he would go and it'd be a very gypsy-like existence. I mean, everywhere he lived, sooner or later, he would wear out his welcome and have to go somewhere else.
He was very outspoken. Baltimore. He was very outspoken
about
in his criticisms of other writers.
Uh-huh.
His nickname was the Tomahawk Man because of his brutal, slashing reviews. He would just tear to pieces a story if he thought it was awful. And he couldn't figure out why people were upset with him after reading these reviews of their stories and how bad these stories were. Poe just couldn't figure out what was wrong. So Ed is right that he created a lot of enemies through his harsh, although justified, criticisms.
Justified,
yes.
He was very passionate about making a great American literature. So if an author came along and said, hey, I'm an American writer, read my stuff, isn't it great? He would say, no, it's not.
What do you think Poe would say?
He would love this. He would love this. And if only because he was not recognized enough in his own time. And that so people were fighting over him now, I think he would be absolutely ecstatic over it.
Oh, I agree. I think he's just rolling around in his grave going, all right, keep going.
Well, let's hear what another listener has to say as we debate who owns Poe. Ed Pettit coming out from Philadelphia, trying to steal him away from us here in Baltimore. And Jeff Drome, who curates the Baltimore Poe House Museum, passionately defending Poe and saying that he will lie on the grave himself to stop. 410-319-8888. Not really, he didn't say that. Hillary in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Oh.
Hi, Hillary.
Yeah. I'm 87 years old, and I first heard about Poe in high school in Providence, Rhode Island. And I remember the purloined letter, the murders in the Rue Morgue. I always thought that it was a cask of Amontillado, but I evidently got that wrong. But my point was that at one point, I lived in Richmond, Virginia, and Poe was raised there by a man by, I believe the name was Allen, who Poe hoped would adopt him, but who never did. And he was quite disappointed by that. So the point I'm probably trying to state is that, Baltimore wants him. They've got him, and that's fine. It should stay here in Baltimore.
There you go.
But he belongs to everybody.
He belongs to everybody.
Yeah.
I think that we had Laura Lippman and some of the other mystery writers, Robert Mosley and the others I've interviewed over the years. They would all kind of pay homage to Poe as kind of the great-grandfather of their writing.
The original piece I wrote in the Philadelphia City Paper, Laura Lippman wrote a rebuttal to it as well. But her argument was basically, we have the body, so possession is nine-tenths of the law.
And we also have on Poe's birthday, the
mysterious Poe toaster.
Who comes and leaves cognac and three roses. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
You know, there, and I mean, there's a passion. I would argue, Ed Pettit, maybe you'd argue the side, there's a passion for Poe here. Because of whether it's legend or reality, that Poe is ours, that doesn't exist in many other places. Any other place, maybe.
I think if he had died in Philadelphia and was buried there, this would have grown up around him in Philadelphia. And because he died in Baltimore and was buried here, this is where it grew up.
So how did Poe really die?
Well, there are, at last count, 22 different theories.
22 different theories.
Different theories concerning his death, and each year a new one pops up, just as ridiculous as the previous one. The truth is, we really don't know what happened to Poe. Whatever happened to him was beyond his control. He died in a hospital, unable to explain what had happened to him. And whenever you have a gray area like that, you have people coming forth with all kinds of silly notions that he died from this, he died from that, brain fever, congestion of the brain, and we don't know. And I think that's fine with me because it's another Poe mystery.
Anything to add to that? Or should we go? Let's go to one more caller and see if we can get somebody else before we have to break. 410-319-8888. Chris, you're in the air, on the air.
How you doing?
Hi, Chris.
Having lived in both Baltimore now and Philly right before this, since Philadelphia has the actual Ravens stuffed and in one of their libraries, you might as well just let Poe rest here.
Yeah, Philadelphia can have the bird.
Yeah.
Well, the raven, rather. Let me explain that.
Please. It's a family show.
I apologize. That was a slip.
That's actually Charles Dickens owned a talking raven named Grip, and he put it in a novel of his, Barnaby Rudge. And when Poe read about this, it probably inspired him to write the Raven. And Poe admitted as much. And he actually read Dickens' story, of course, in Philadelphia. So he was inspired to write the Raven while he was in Philadelphia.
Ravens are just brilliant birds. And
they're
just wonderful birds. Well, gentlemen, I'm glad to see you here. And we can get you to Philly. We can get you back to Baltimore debating Enoch Pratt.
Great.
I'll volunteer my services to have this debate before our live audience at Enoch Pratt. And see this debate take place. There's a poll room there. Jeff Jerome and Ed Pettit, it's a pleasure to have you. Meet you, Ed, here. And it's a pleasure to have you. See you again, Jeff Jerome. And
thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you can go and see more about this on our webpage and find out how to see more about Ed Pettit and more. And thank you both so much for being
thank
here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go visit our Poe home. It's a place, great museum.
Yes, it is.
To go see. We're going to take a short break when we come back. Mark Sumner will join us. Who's a Daily Kos contributing editor and author of Devil's Tower column with a very interesting thoughts on this bailout of Wall Street. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. We're about to talk to Mark Sumner. And Mark Sumner is a contributing editor to Daily Kos and author of the Devil's Tower column. And we read his column yesterday on Daily Kos about what's going on in the economy. Before we talk to him, let me introduce him a little bit to you so you know who he is. Those of you who don't know him, he has written 32 novels, including The Devil's Tower. And he's a past winner of Writers of the Future, the nominator for both Nebula and World Fantasy Awards. In addition to the books, he's written over 50 short stories and countless articles. And one was an inspiration for a TV series you might remember, you might not, The Chronicle. In his years on the planet, he's been a newspaper photographer, coal miner, software engineer, geologist, perpetual student, lives in a log cabin out in the country somewhere beyond St. Louis. And they say from this piece that he's practicing to become a grouchy old hermit at that young age. And he's worked on campaigns for 30 years. And as it says here, he's never risen higher than knocker on doors and maker of annoying phone calls. And I would add, writer of wonderful columns for Daily Kos. And Mark, it's good to talk to you.
Very nice to talk to you today, Mark.
So, since you're writing about this, what's going on with credit default swaps and this bailout being proposed by Paulson and the Bush administration, and the fact that you're a science fiction writer has some connection, I think.
in that it does seem incredible what we're experiencing today, does. It seems like something that should come out of a bad novel, doesn't it?
It does. I often wonder what reality these swaps and this kind of hedge fund mentality have. And what its relationship to the reality of our economy really is?
You know, the sheer numbers on these credit default swaps are so astounding. You know, the estimates on just last year's activity in credit default swaps, somewhere between $45 and $70 trillion.
Oof.
Meaning at the low end, it's three times the gross domestic product of the country. You know, at the high end, it's $5 trillion more than the gross domestic product of the world.
But I mean, you're not an economist, so what does that mean to you? What does that mean to all of us that those kind of numbers are thrown out there? I mean, what's the relationship to reality of most people on the planet or in this country, do you think?
Well, there's not a lot of relationship to reality except that people have had their assets placed at risk much greater than they really deserve. You know, if you look at the actual number of mortgages that are falling into defaults, you're looking at about 3% of mortgages. So that's historically high, but it's not horribly high. And if you were to tell the banks, gee, they have to go out and pay off 3% of the mortgages, you might be looking at a big number, but it certainly wouldn't be $700 billion or a trillion mm-hmm. to make that payment. But because these guys have been allowed to create all these derivatives and swaps and inflate and trade these things back and forth among each other as investments, they've built up a heap and stack of theoretical deficits they've built a debt that we now get to pick up for them that never really existed. It's not our fault. It's not even the fault of people that took bad mortgages. It's the fault of these guys that decided to turn bad mortgages into an investment vehicle.
Now, you have a line in what you wrote the other day, and I want to talk about this line before we go back to some of the history where you kind of outline how this happened to us. And I think it's a really important lesson. And you say, this is enemy action. This is a bullet deliberately fired into the economy by men willing to exercise their ideology regardless of the cost to taxpayers.
Sure. I do believe that. If you look back at the history, and I'll sum it up real quickly, you know, if you go back and look at the savings and loan problem, you had guys putting in the same sort of deregulation, you had the same sort of kind of creative, as they say, investments generated, and within 7 to 8 years, you had the taxpayer having to step in to bail out the system. If you look at what happened with commodities trading, and in particular what happened with electrical trading with Enron, you had a law put in, deregulated the system. Within a year, these guys had come up with all kinds of clever ways to cheat the system, and within a year, we had a massive collapse, and the taxpayer had to step in. And then they turned right around again, and in fact, in a lot of the same regulations that deregulated commodities and energy are still affecting us today because they also deregulated the credit default swaps. And we can't really keep thinking, gee, these guys just don't know what they're doing. These guys are making millions and billions at each turn of this cycle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're deliberately putting us at risk because they know they can gut the system for whatever they can get, and at the end of it, we'll step in to pay.
What do you think the argument is being made now by some people? There was a New York Times columnist this morning in the business section who wrote that that maybe we shouldn't be bailing them out. Maybe this is not the correct answer. Maybe that everyone's pushing this much too fast. We should step back and wait a minute to see how this money should be spent.
Well, you know, as you said, I'm not an economist, but there certainly seems like there are a lot more potential answers here than the one plan that's being put in front of us. You know, the simplest one to me is, you know, we look back again, just 3% of mortgages are falling into default. Right now, if you have to go into bankruptcy court, if you've got bad credit card debt, the judge can negotiate with the credit card company and they can come up with new numbers so you can make your payments. If you've got a vacation home and you've got a problem with the mortgage on that vacation home, the judge can negotiate with the bank and come up with a new agreement. But on your primary residence, they can't do that. That's against the law right now. If they would just make that modification so that these mortgages could be renegotiated by a judge in a bankruptcy court, we've already got the system set up for doing it. We've already got the people to do it. And that would take out of the equation those real mortgages that, you know, they want to pretend are the problem. And then at least we could focus on their activities with derivatives and swaps. And I think people would be a lot less sympathetic to bailing these guys out if it's not about bad mortgages and people having homes and more about these guys just trading money around and inflating each other's bottom line.
I wonder what the reality is, and maybe neither you nor I have the answer to this at the moment, but I'd like to find out what the reality is about if we did not bail them out. People are saying, oh, if you don't bail them out now, then we're going to be having to get mounts of gold to buy a loaf of bread, or that exactly. No one's going to be able to get credit to the bank. But I've heard the people going to the bank today, business people I've talked to, saying, no, they can still get loans. So if that's the case, then what are we bailing out here?
That, you know, that does seem to be the ultimate bottom line scare tactic is this absolute lack of liquidity, that you won't be able to get a loan to buy a house, you won't be able to get a loan to buy a car. But you know, I don't see the evidence for that, because you know, these banks that are still in existence to make money, and that they make that money by loaning funds to people that have good credit. So I don't see why people that have good credit would be hurt if we failed to buy out the people that had been irresponsible in how they managed these loans.
So let's go back to a bit of history, which is what you do so very well in the piece that you wrote on Daily Kos, about the history of the Graham-Leach-Bliley bill.
Yeah.
And what preceded it, and the steps you see that got us to this place in the first place.
Well, like I say, if you go back to 1982, we'll take one step back and look at, at Garn-St-Germain, which was the bill that substantially deregulated the savings and loan industry. Up until that time, savings and loans had been, you know, really pretty tightly reined in into the kinds of activities they could engage in. Well, Garn-St-Germain gave them most of the abilities that regular commercial banks had. They could now get involved in a lot of different instruments, but it didn't give them all the regulations that banks had. So they had a lot of freedom to get out there and, like they say, get creative, and they did. They got creative, they got extravagant, and in a very short time, the taxpayer was on the hook, back then, in fact, was on the hook for $400 billion, which I haven't done the adjustment into today's dollars, but it's probably a pretty close equivalent to what we're facing now. Fortunately, a lot of what we got then, we took over 747 failing savings and loans. They were mostly small institutions. That's why there were 747 of them. And a lot of the assets that we got then were actually assets worth having, and we were able to sell them so that in the end, the taxpayer was only down about $120 billion, which is still a pretty big bill to hand the taxpayer for what they did. But what happened then in 1999 with Phil Graham at the head of it, when they passed that bill, they really repealed critical parts of bills that had been in place since 1933, in particular the Glass-Steagall Act. And those bills, you know, had a couple of purposes. One was to put some limits on banks and how they could get mingled up with insurance and how they could get mingled up with commodities trading and how they could get mingled up with stock. And they also put some limits on how they could merge it wasn't like people hadn't been breaking that rule with some impunity over the time period between 1933 and 1999. But after Graham put his bill in place, they had open season to do it. And most people, if you just look at the name on your checkbook, you know, have a pretty good idea that banks have been changing hands regularly and rapidly, with larger and larger institutions coming around. And, you know, now we're at that point where we have those institutions that are, as they say, too large to fail. We've let them merge from all different sectors of the fiscal industry so that we've got these giant bank, brokerage, insurance company hybrids whose destruction would be too damaging to the economy, we're told. So we can't allow these guys to fail. They've got to be bailed out in one way or another. And really, Glass-Steagall was exactly intended to prevent that kind of thing from happening because they had just seen what happened when banks failed during the Great Depression, and they didn't want to see it again.
What does all this have to do with, as you wrote about, Alan Greenspan, his love of credit default swaps, the removal of Volcker as the head of the Fed by Ronald Reagan, and all this kind of ties together that led us to where we are now?
You know, it's funny. Greenspan is this, you know, respected elder statesman of the fiscal community these days, but he's been wrong at every turn. If you look back during the savings and loan debacle, who was cheering that on? Alan Greenspan. When you get back even directly to Charles Keating and the Keating Five, we remember the senators. We remember John McCain's involvement from the Senate side. But, you know, most people don't remember that Alan Greenspan was just as deeply involved and, in fact, went to Reagan, pushed Reagan to get one of Keating's friends appointed to the Home Loan Board so that that helped keep Keating in business for an extra couple of years so he could keep scamming people. Greenspan, you know, has been, along with Phil Graham, you know, at the head of the Church of Deregulation, egging it on at every point. He cheered Graham's bills, both in modernizing commodities and in deregulating banks. And Greenspan, when he looked at these credit default swaps, thought that they were a great idea. Greenspan's idea was that these things would spread around the risk. So I take a risky loan, and boy, I might fail if I've got too many of those risky loans. But by getting insurance from a number of different parties, now the risk is spread around. And if I should start defaulting on my risky loans, well, it's a small hurt to a lot of people instead of just a big hurt to me. That might have been true if these guys had not gone overboard and started trading these default swaps as investment vehicles. But Greenspan actually cheered on both the fact that they could be traded that way, that they were opaque, that people couldn't see what was going on with them, that the SEC can't even track them except kind of indirectly. You know, this thing is kind of like looking for a black cat in the dark. You can kind of only see them by the other things they move around. You can't observe them directly.
Well, I'm sorry. Had you finished?
Sure.
I didn't want to interrupt you. But then you make these, when you said you can't see what they're doing, and you don't know where they're kind of wandering in the dark here for us, you make these other connections between that, them, Enron, the California debacle, remember that you wrote about, that people forget about? And
right.
When Gray Davis was governor and the speculators manipulated the cost of energy, and California public utilities were going bankrupt.
Yeah.
All these are connected to this moment we're living in right now by the stuff you're writing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in 2000, when Graham passed the act that, quote, modernized commodities trading, part of what was in that bill was that it explicitly hid certain commodities and certain types of fiscal instruments from regulation. Not just, you know, kept any more regulation from occurring on these guys, but explicitly kept the SEC from looking at some of these things. So in the case of Enron, when you look at electrical trading, the amazing number to me is that previous to the passage of this bill, California, in its whole history, it had one Class 3, one really large blackout.
Mm-hmm.
Within 11 months after this bill was passed, they had 38. that's how rapidly these guys figured out how to maneuver and manipulate the energy market in California.
Well, could you explain and break that down for us in simple terms? How did that work? How did that happen? What's the connection?
The main way was that they took plants, you know, offline. They managed to have coincidental plants out of business, you know, for maintenance at the same time. And to do this took some pretty massive maneuvering. In the summer in California, it's hot. You're using a lot of energy for air conditioning. So a lot of times the electrical grid out there is pretty close to capacity. But in the winter, you've essentially got four times as much production capacity in California as you do consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, these guys managed to stage a blackout on January 16th.
So, if all these insidious connections exist, and I am not a huge conspiracy theorist, but if all these connect, I mean, what does it say to you about these connections, and what does it say to you about the kind of questions that the people in Washington need to be answering for us right now?
You know, I don't know. As kind of the conclusion of my article was that, you know, on the one hand, maybe these guys really are that dumb. You know, maybe their ideology is so strong that they just believe in deregulation no matter what. Free market must run free. And, you know, the fact that it just keeps coming around and biting us all in the rear is, you know, coincidence that just happens to happen over and over and over again. Maybe they really don't know what they're doing. On the other hand, maybe they do. You know, if you look back at, like, the shock doctrine, I think that's a term that has popped up in conversation a lot over the last week. And there's a lot of people that have the suspicion that this kind of crisis is exactly the goal of the kind of deregulation that they've been practicing over the last decade.
And it's gotten to this point, and when you say maybe they're not as dumb as you might think, making $45 trillion in credit default swaps across the globe, that when you have Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, and under President Clinton, one of his predecessors is Goldman Sachs, Robert Rubin, that there's such a connection between these guys on Wall Street who are speculators and who want this open free market to make as much money as they want, who then can take a semi-retirement for 48 years to be Secretary of Treasury before they go back to whatever they do. I mean, there are connections here that, while they might not be conspiratorial, they're so close and so incestuous.
Right.
I mean, that to me is where the danger lives.
Well,
these
are fellows that have made an assumption that what's good for them is good for the country, you know, and they make the assumption that the failure of Morgan Stanley or Bank of America would be a disaster for Main Street, as we've started saying in the last few weeks. But, you know, they don't present great evidence for that, and certainly the kind of bad behavior that has gone on Wall Street over the last couple of decades has certainly been bad for people in general, and I'm not quite sure why we should help them out at this point when they're very unwilling to help us out.
Now, have you contemplated for maybe some other stuff you're writing about what would happen if they were not bailed out?
You know, of course, you hear doom and gloom, and like we said before, the problem of liquidity is the one that most often comes up. If you don't bail these guys out, then it's going to make other people much more reluctant to lend money. But, you know, liquidity is already at a pretty stagnant point, but people that have good credit are still able to get credit, and I don't see any reason to suspect that would change. So I haven't seen yet beyond the various superficial kind of Armageddon statements that Paulson and Bernanke were tossing out yesterday, what we really should be dreading if we don't bail these guys out.
Well, Mark, something you've given us a lot of food for thought. I think our next step should be to find people like Stiglitz and others to talk to us about what would happen if we didn't bail them out, and maybe what's a better economic scenario for the American people than spending $1 trillion on those who already have $1 trillion.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of options out there other than the one that's being presented to us. And whether it's the shock doctrine or not, we certainly shouldn't be stampeded into handing not just a very large chunk of money, but a decent amount of our representative democracy over to Hank Paulson to take care of this.
Well, we will continue reading you, Mark Sumner, the Devil's Tower column and the Daily Kos, and want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to remind everyone to join me now over at the Northwood Shopping Center for a rally, Enough is Enough, in front of the New Haven Lounge as we remember Councilman Ken Harris, who was murdered, and talk about what we can do about our city. Enough is Enough, right now over at Northwood Shopping Center. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're directed and engineered this hour by Zachary Coleman. Our intern and interim producer is Judith Lloyd. You can podcast this show and all other productions on our website. Just go to MarkSteinerShow.com. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark.